Thank you, Daryl. I appreciate it. I'm honored to be here, and I just want to applaud you for being here. We all are concerned about BSD, but we can do something about BVD, and I applaud that you're here. And so we're going to get started with talking about some of the basics. And our first speaker today is Dr. Julia Woodpath, and she's in Ames, Iowa. She has a PhD in molecular biology from Iowa State University, and she's the lead scientist at the National Animal Disease Center, which is part of USDA. Anyway, she is one, her lab and Dr. Woodpath is the one really sort of who's found out about the BVD viral 2 and the changes as far as the respiratory and the virulent. And so we've asked her to come and sort of set the information for all of us about the different strains and types, and that she can really fine tune this. And so trying to keep her 20 minutes is going to be a task, not to keep her. She can do it, but she can also get very much into detail. But we welcome Dr. Woodpath, and you've got 20 minutes, okay?
You can leave a high sign.
I will.
Good morning. Well, we're going to be talking about BVD today, and I'd like to just give you an introduction into the bug. It's bovine viral diarrhea virus. Sometimes we say virus, but I'd like to impress upon you that BVD, there's thousands of different strains out there that do thousands of different things. So we're not just talking about one entity. It's a pathogen of ruminants found worldwide. It also infects white-tailed deer, mule-tailed deer, elk. You can get persistent infections in these wildlife species, too. Estimated losses in the United States, this is based on some work that Hans Howe did. It's estimated 35 to 56 million per million calves born. Another way of looking at it, for every calf born in the United States, about $35 is lost to BVD. Maybe not in that particular calf, but overall. So this is significant. These losses are expressed in outright mortality, reduced growth rates, reproductive failure, and that's probably where the rubber meets the road on BVD, reproductive failure, including those persistently infected animals, and increased virulence of other pathogens. A lot of BVD out there probably goes undetected. And I apologize for showing you some old data. This is from 94, but it's the most recent national survey we have of just samples confirmed by that was BVD that were just submitted to laboratories. And they weren't really always looking for BVD. They just had clinically bad outcomes. And so when we look at this classic mucosal disease, with only 13% of those things that were finally found BVD. 9% were acute respiratory. At this point, we didn't know too much about hemorrhagic syndrome. We were just starting to see it. BVD-associated abortions, 10%. Here's a hemorrhagic syndrome at 1%. Associated pneumonia at 11%. Diarrhea, which is what the name leads you to think. You're going to see diarrhea, but as you can see, most of what you see is not diarrhea. And 42% of the cases submitted that were found to be BVD positive were not identified as a BVD clinical picture in the field. They were submitted to diagnostic laboratories because the animal was either extremely sick or had died, and they weren't even looking for BVD. 42% of the cases. So BVD is not going to jump out with a placard and say, I'm BVD, I'm your problem. BVD is going to look like a lot of other things. It's going to look like respiratory disease. It's going to look like reproductive disease. It can look like enteric disease. It may just look like dumpy animals. Sometimes it's written off as bad genetics because it's animals who just don't recover and come back online for production. So BVD is not easy to recognize in the field. So what happens when an animal is infected with BVD? The disease associated with BVD is going to be strain dependent. Remember I told you there are thousands of different strains of BVD out there, and they look like a lot of different things. It's also going to depend on the immune status of the animal. If you have titers of 1 to 16 or 1 to 32 against the particular strain that's infecting, you may escape some of the clinical signs. You still will replicate the virus. You'll still infect everybody else in the pen next to you. But in an acute situation, you may not see it. So that's another thing that of the presentation in a population of animals, because we have differing levels of immune status of titers in those animals, we're going to have a different clinical picture in the pen. Reproductive status. It may not cause any problem clinically in the dam. You might not even know it went through. But you will see a infection of the fetus leading to abortion, mummification, repeat breeding, persistently infected animals, clinical congenital malformations. poor doing calves, weak calves. And it's also dependent on the presence of other pathogens. BVD makes everything else look worse, particularly in conjunction with Pasteurella or respiratory syncytial virus. BVD will give you a fulminating pneumonia in conjunction with those pathogens that you might not see otherwise. One take-home message I'd like you to take with you today is BVD attacks the immune system. That's where it likes to live. So the very defense system that the animal's trying to use to fight off the disease is what BVD goes after. And even the mildest BVD that you won't see clinical signs from can deplete that immune system 20 to 30% when based on circulating lymphocytes. So the types of BVD infection, BVD does a lot of things. We have acute infection in the non-pregnant animal. We have acute infection in the pregnant animal. And these really give you two different clinical pictures. This one can lead to the persistently infected animal. But first, let's talk about acute infection. The majority of cases out there are subclinical or clinically mild. Lots of times we see it with respiratory disease, particularly in co-infections with secondary pathogens. The other thing BVD with acute infections will give you is immune suppression that sets it up for a secondary infection. So BVD might not be there for the when the bacteria walks in, but it's knocked down the immune system so the bacteria can take over. We also have the severe acute or paracute, which can lead to hemorrhagic syndrome. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. And then we have acute infections of pregnant animals, which can lead to reproductive failure, congenital defects in this persistently infected animal. Now, a little bit of the problem with the way we think about BVD is we focus a lot on this persistently infected animal. But this animal is the tip of the iceberg. We have all this other stuff going on to produce the PI animal. PI, to get a PI animal, all conditions have to be perfect. The animal has to be infected in the right term of pregnancy. It has to have an immune system that will let the virus through. The fetus has to be infected but not harmed enough so it isn't aborted. So sometimes guys say, well, I know I have a BVD problem. I've got animals out there that just look kind of skunky. They're not coming along. I think it's BVD, and they go in and they survey and they only find one BVD positive persistent in the animal. I say, well, one out of 200. Big deal. How could that be my problem? That one out of 200 represents a lot of other infections. So even one is significant. So let's talk a little bit about outcomes of in utero infection. You can have the delayed breeding. So lots of times people don't even pick up that they have a BVD problem. They just think, well, things aren't being bred. I didn't have a good bull. The AI didn't work, when it's actually BVD. You can get the abortion and stillbirth. You do have abortion storms associated with BVD. You can have the persistently infected animal. And you can have the antibody positive, virus negative. This is a fetus that was exposed in utero, but its immune system was developed enough it fought it off. And these outcomes really depend on when the animal, what stage of gestation the animal was infected in. And in case you're wondering what that was, I asked our graphics department to show me a pregnant cow, and so they gave me a cow in a maternity box. Okay, so early on, you have a tendency to get, depending on the strain, some strains cause more abortions than others. You'll get abortions, resorption, mummification, or just repeat breeding. During the first trimester, this is when, if we get infection of the fetus at this point, it can lead to persistent infection. Now, when I'm talking here about these infections, this can happen with either a cytopathic or a non-cytopathic virus. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But we're led to believe, or that's kind of an old wives' tale, that cytopathic viruses cannot get through to the fetus. I have isolated cytopathic viruses from dead fetuses. Cytopathic viruses can get through. Cytopathic viruses can cause some of these problems. What they won't do is establish persistent infection. That only happens with the non-cytopathic. And most of the viruses out there are non-cytopathic. Well above 95% of the viruses in nature are non-cytopathic. And here's the animal we always thought, well, didn't really have a problem. Antibody positive, but are they normal? Some of the work coming out of UC Davis says these animals do have problems later on in life. They have a tendency to have higher costs associated with treatments, particularly for respiratory disease. Some of them don't do well with vaccinations. And there's some evidence out there now that they don't have good production records, good reproductive records. So even having an animal born with a positive title, we used to think they were home free. Now we think there's a damage. And this all makes sense because the fetus, every cell in that fetus has an agenda. It's supposed to be developing into something else. This is the most vulnerable time of the animal's life for infecting any cell population. And BVD goes in there. Infection with the virus is not a benign event. Because the virus is getting in there and it wants to pervert the cell machinery to doing what the virus needs to do. So when BVD is telling these developing cells that are supposed to be making the lungs or the immune system or the long bones or the muscles to go ahead and make BVD virus, it's making BVD virus when it should be doing something else. So, it's not a benign event. So, outcome of infection of the persistently infected animal. So far, I've just talked about acute infections. These persistently infected animals do have a special problem nobody else has. If we have this persistently infected animal, can be super infected with a cytopathic virus, and they may develop that cytopathic virus on their own, or they may pick it up from the outside, they can develop mucosal disease. Now, we talk about late-onset mucosal disease that's usually in conjunction with a virus that comes from the outside, frequently a vaccine strain. And you can have some clinical disease with these guys that may eventually die. But the classic mucosal disease, they're super infected with a cytopathic, and they're gone in about 10 days, and it's pretty dramatic. While this is really pretty dramatic, and it's got a lot of press from the scientific community because it's a fun little disease to work with, it's not a major loss leader for you. You're not going to see a lot of mucosal disease. So we're going to go back and talk about the typical progression of acute infection. You'll get a basic fever. BVD will give you two peaks. You may not really realize that first peak. Animals really don't get too dumpy in the first peak. It's that second peak where they are really not feeling too good. And with the more virulent viruses, it's the second peak where they're going to be running temperatures of 105, 106. Viremia. The virus can be isolated from buffy coat serum and nasal swabs between days 3 and 11. Lymphocyte drop happens to days 6 and 9. The lymphocyte drop will be anywhere, even with the most mild viruses, will be anywhere from 15% to the most virulent viruses to 60% of the circulating lymphocytes will disappear. Platelet drop, this only happens with the highly virulent viruses, those that cause hemorrhagic syndrome. That'll happen at days 9 to 11. And you'll get the dumpiness and the depression later on in the infection on days 9 to 11. So look up here, when we're getting virus isolation, precedes when we're getting the clinical signs, clinical disease in days 9 through 13. So frequently what's going on is you have the bad-looking animal, and so you take the samples from that animal who looks clinically the worst, thinking, well, if I send that one to the diagnostic lab, that's my best shot for isolating the virus. That's actually not your best shot. Your best shot in that population, take some from the animal that's really clinically ill, but also try to get some from those animals who look like they may be entering into the phase. Because frequently, your virus is going to be gone by the time you're seeing clinical signs. Because in this particular disease, it seems to be the animal's response to the virus rather than just the replication of the virus itself. I want to talk a little bit about severe acute versus clinically mild. Severe acute disease, we're going to see temperatures above 105 degrees, and that's going to last 3 or 4 days. And frequently, that's really all you'll see in the field in a pen of animals. They'll say, well, we took the temperature one day, it was 105, and they were dead the next. You're not going to see a screaming diarrhea. You're not going to see respiratory signs. You may just see that high temperature. That's in the absence of secondary pathogens. You're going to get this large decrease in circulating white blood cells, and you're going to get a decrease in platelets. With clinically mild, you're going to get a temperature too, but it's usually going to be short durations, maybe a day or two, and less than 104 degrees. A decrease between 15 and 30% in those circulating white blood cells, which is significant. That's giving you you're attacking your immune system, but you're not going to get a decrease in platelets. So persistent infection from mucosal disease, just talk a little bit about that. We have to talk about cytopathic and non-cytopathic viruses. This was first determined in the late 1950s by their activity in cultured epithelial cells, and that cytopathic viruses killed cells within 48 days in culture, non-cytopathic don't. In acute infections, the animal really can't tell the difference between these two. You'll get the same clinical signs in an acute, uncomplicated infection with both cytopathic or non-cytopathic. This because it becomes important in reproductive disease, because only the non-cytopathic can establish the persistent infection. But let's remember that doesn't mean the cytopathic can't get through. If you have an animal persistently infected with a non-cytopathic, with the correct cytopathic you can get mucosal disease. Now, because the cytoplasmic virus doesn't give rise to persistently infected animals, this is what's been in the modified live vaccines, because the last thing a vaccine company wants to do is have you vaccinate and then have a bunch of persistently infected animals born that have their viral strain in it. Now, I'm not saying they're safer than the non-cytopathics. I'm not saying they don't cause disease. What I am saying is they won't give you persistently infected animals. Also, there's also a little old wives' tale out there that because cytopathic viruses can kill persistently infected animals, there's an old wives' tale that one way to get rid of your PI animals is to vaccinate them. Sometimes this works. Sometimes you will pick up a mucosal disease and get rid of them. But a persistently infected animal can respond to a vaccine strain, can make antibodies against the vaccine strain. It has to be a particular match between the non-cytopathic and the cytopathic virus that gives mucosal disease. So, one, you can't kill off your PIs by vaccinating, and two, you can't depend on a low titer after vaccination to indicate whether you have PI animals or not. The persistently infected animal will not respond immunologically to the virus it carries, but that's a pretty narrow and a very tight immunotolerance. It can respond to other BVD viruses, and it will respond to other BVD viruses. So, there used to be another old wives' tale out there, if you just do the serology after vaccination and everybody responded to the vaccine, then you don't have PIs. That's not true. So, talk a little bit more about the PI. It has a non-cytopathic virus. Its immune system is tolerant of that virus. It does not recognize the virus that it was exposed to in utero. It can react to other BVD. They may have malformations, or they may be completely normal. Somebody sent me a picture from the Grand Champion Bull from the Wisconsin State Fair, I think it was about 10 or 15 years ago, who was a PI animal. He looked gorgeous. But you may have these stubby calves, you may have them with the sickle hock and the shortened faces. You may also see some of these malformations in animals born with antibody positive, just exposed in utero but didn't become PI. And you have to remember, these animals shed virus continually throughout their lifetime, so they are the original typhoid Marys. And if you don't get rid of your PIs, even with your vaccinating, that PI animal is continually shedding that. They're causing acute disease. They're affecting the immune system of everything around them. They're making every other pathogen worse. The other thing, if you're vaccinating in the face of a PI, long-term PI in your herd, what you're selecting for that PI to produce is a virus that will sedate your vaccination program. So vaccination without eliminating PI is not doing you a lot of good. So once again, just the pathogenesis of mucosal disease, I think we've hit that enough. Clinically severe infections. Sometimes these clinically severe infections are mistaken for mucosal disease. So I'd just like to differentiate between them. We have severe acute BVD, which may lead to hemorrhagic syndrome. You can have severe acute BVD that will kill animals so that you won't get the bleeder syndrome. In fact, you won't see really much for clinical signs or in gross pathology. What you will see is the high temperatures marked by dropping platelets and lymphocytes. You get death in 10 to 15% of the cases, but animals do get sick and recover. The gross lesions are pretty unremarkable in these guys. Microscopically, we can see just almost a complete depletion of lymphoid tissue, but just when you pop that thing open, you're not going to see a heck of a lot that will point you towards it being BVD. And there's only one BVD virus present. Hemorrhagic syndrome, you get the same high temperatures. It's actually these guys progress to hemorrhagic syndrome, some of them, because they have such a drop in platelets. Death rate's about the same, but you'll see these really dramatic hemorrhages throughout the GI tract, very marked gross lesions, particularly in the palate. Once again, just one virus. But this is just an expression of this. So when you have an outbreak of a highly virulent virus, you'll see a few of these guys, but you'll have a lot of these guys. What you see in mucosal disease is there won't be so many animals infected. Temperature ranges won't be high. There'll be a marked drop in lymphocytes, but not platelets. It's 100% fatal. These guys have a chance of recovering. These guys don't. Once you go down the road of mucosal disease, you're gone. Very marked gross lesions, and there'll be always be two viruses present, a cytopathic and a non-cytopathic. So aftermath of infection. So we've gone through this acute infection, even with a highly virulent virus, and the animal's recovering, their lymphocyte count's coming back, it's all over, right? Life is good. Well, it ain't over until the fat lady sings. Body conditions 30 days post-infection. So what we did is we infected jabs with a virulent virus, and then we just looked at their weight gains 60 days post-infection. So these are animals who had all recovered. Their lymphocyte and platelet counts came back to normal. They had nice high titers against BVD 30 days out. Look at the body conditions. And I really apologize for showing jerseys to cattlemen. This does qualify as a bovine species, okay? But it's cheaper for me to get dairy species than beef in the area I'm in. But let's just see 30 days out, and it's still evident 60 days out. These animals are about 20% lower in body weight gain, and when you do get gain, rather getting it in muscle and long bone, you're getting it in abdominal fat. So you can see that they don't have the muscle structure in the hind quarter, the brisket's low. You can see the ribs, and you can also see they're just putting on abdominal fat. Now, somebody getting this into a feeder operation would just say, well, bad genetics, these are just stumpy, rotten calves. They have high titers against BVD. There would be no reason for that feeder to suspect at that point that it had originated as a BVD problem. But this is BVD, and we think we're probably underestimating the amount of BVD out there because we're not looking at cases like this. This is BVD damage long after the fact. And what happens is BVD attacks those cells as they're trying to make long bones and muscle, and they're not getting the support they need. And these animals just don't come back online. I have to talk just a little bit about BVD genotypes here. We do have BVD 1 and 2, which are now considered separate species. So while they may look exactly alike clinically, they're actually two different branches of the family tree of these viruses. So just like donkeys and horses are different species, and they do all the same things, these are two different species. They're two different bugs. What originally tipped us off that there might be BVD2 out there is we had vaccine breaks in situations we thought they were well-managed herds vaccinating with a vaccine that happened to contain a BVD1. We were seeing breaks of BVD2. We started characterizing those viruses. We found they actually belonged to a different branch of the family tree. Eventually, we divided that into two genotypes. This is based on phylogenetic analysis originally, but it's been confirmed now by antigenic differences, and it's the way animals respond to them are significantly different. And it's also borne out in polyclonal Anisteria. The family of viruses that BVD belongs to is the flavivirus family, and within that genus, that family, there's a genus called Pestivirus, and that's where BVD belongs. The members of the Pestivirus genus that are important in agriculture are BVD1, BVD2, border disease virus, which is a cause of the reproductive disease in sheep, and classical swine fever virus, also known as called cholera virus. They are all cross-reactive. So you will have people say there's cross-reaction between BVD1 and BVD2. What I'm showing you here is animals that were hyper-immunized with one of these viruses. And then I took a different strain and just saw how well their serum recognized that strain. And so the higher the number, the better they recognize the strain. Okay? So an animal asked to respond to a BVD1 virus will do a better job of finding other BVD1 viruses than they do of finding BVD2. They will find them, but not at a good rate. Those asked to recognize a BVD2 will do the best against another BVD2 virus, but won't do as well against the BVD1s or the border disease or the hog cholera. So when we're talking about cross-reactivity between BVD1 and BVD2, it is there. But in some cases, it's really no better than the difference between the cross-reactivity between classical swine fever virus and either one of the two species of BVD. So these are significant differences. So just to leave you with summation, we have BVD1 and BVD2. I haven't talked too much about it today. We do have subgroups within those branches. We have 1A, 1B, 2A, 2B. We can have cytopathic, non-cytopathic biotypes from either genus, or from either genotype. All of these can cause acute infections, and we don't want to underestimate what's happening with acute infections out in the field. But only the non-cytopathic can give rise to persistent infection, and the non-cytopathic do predominate in nature. Superinfection with the cytopathic virus can give you mucosal disease, which is really pretty scary looking, but you don't see very often. What you do see more often probably in the field is severe acute BVD, which can be mistaken for mucosal disease or may not have much of those lesions at all.
We're going to have a question and answer session after three talks, and then we took a break. But next on is Dr. Bob Larson, and he's going to talk about the economic human structure, and then maybe you can get that from Dr. Woodpath. Dr. Larson is at the University of Missouri. Excuse me, Missouri. Sorry. Kentucky, Missouri. But he is a veterinarian that is teaching at the College of Veterinary Medicine. He's a beef production specialist. He received his veterinary degree at Kansas State University and then was in private practice, went back and got his PhD. So he's a double doctor here and was in Abilene, Kansas for a while as a cow-calf and a backgrounder consultant. And he's now at the University of Missouri working in the production medicine group and a spearheader of the BDD. And Dr. Larson, we've asked you to talk about the economics and production effects in DVD in 20 minutes once again. I know you could take several hours, but thank you very much.
You're saying I'm long-winded.
I guess you have a lot to tell us.
Okay. Well, we are going to try to cover a few things, and hopefully we will have time during the question and answer time to delve into this a little bit further. And I think one of the reasons that we're having this meeting today is that there's been a lot of discussion about BDD over the last few years, and you might ask yourself, well, this is not a new disease. Why are we having some kind of renewed interest in this disease? I think there's a couple of reasons. One is the perception that it's involved in a fair percentage of the wrecks we see. As a veterinary practitioner, you know, I don't know how to estimate exactly, but between cow-calf abortion problems, scouring calf problems, problems with stalker calves, those kinds of things, you know, I don't know, maybe some of these BDD problems are easily 10-20% of the wrecks that we deal with. So that's a significant number of the problems that we deal with. The other thing is that it does affect all of the cattle that we might work with. Whether you are a cow-calf producer, suddenly some suckling calf health issues, or pregnant cows, adult cows, either trying to get them bred, abortion problems, heifer development loss, as well as stalker cattle and feeder cattle, all of the segments of the industry deal with BDD as a problem. So I think that's another reason why it's kind of on the forefront of disease control that we are attacking. The other thing is that it's a fairly good disease to attack. It has a defined reservoir. From a control standpoint, PI calves, like Dr. Ridpath said, are really just the tip of the iceberg as far as the total BDD problem and circulating virus. But from a control standpoint, they're a great target. That is where almost all of our BDD virus comes from, and it's a definable source. And it's definable because we've gotten some relatively new tests. In the last few years, we've got an ear notch test using immunohistochemistry. We have PCR, which is a very sensitive test that can be used on a number of body fluids. These are brand new tests that have allowed us to find this reservoir. Therefore, we take an old disease, we have some new tests, we can really attack it in some new ways. And the other thing is there's been some new vaccine labels come out, labels that have discussed things like fetal protection. All of those things have brought BDD to the forefront of disease control discussion. So, when we look at the economic losses, much like Dr. Ridpath was saying, we have to look at things like the reproductive losses, clinical diseases from acute infections. In other words, true BDD cases. Maybe not a particularly large number, but they're part of the economic loss. I think a common economic loss is part of other disease complexes. It's a little harder to get our hands around what the economic cost of this is, but it's in there somewhere. These are the immune suppression that Dr. Ridpath discussed, affecting a number of different diseases that we may see in the herd of cattle. And then finally, also the losses of the persistently infected cattle themselves. That's a pretty small economic loss in that the loss of themselves, but they are a huge part of the problem because they are the reservoir of the virus. So we see BDD costing us money in the area of the respiratory disease complex, scours, diarrhea, particularly in young calves, abortions and stillbirths, poorly performing suckling calves at the cow-calf level, all are economic losses due to this virus. Dr. Ridpath talked some about the transmission. When we talk about control programs, which is what I'm going to get to a little bit later in the morning, there's a couple of things that we need to understand about this virus. There's really two methods that the virus passes from one animal to another. We call one horizontal, in that it occurs after birth, and it's occurring with animals that are in contact with each other. This virus is mostly passed from one animal to another through ingestion or inhalation of the virus itself. I'm going to use the term transiently infected animal as opposed to a persistently infected animal. And a transiently infected animal is one of these viruses that was born healthy, normal immune system, was not exposed during the pregnancy, but then down on the ground and gets exposed to the virus. That animal most typically will shed the virus 4 to 10 days, maybe a little bit longer, a couple of weeks. And oppose that to the persistently infected animals that are going to shed the virus throughout their lifetime. Much different amount of exposure we have between these two animals. This is a real problem. This is a very real problem. The virus does persist in the environment, but only for a short period of time. This is not a virus that contaminates an environmental area and stays there. So it's a component of transfer, but not a huge component. The other way that virus can move from one animal to another is what we call vertical transmission. That's basically from mother to offspring during pregnancy. So the fetus is infected. When the mother gets infected with the virus is circulating in her bloodstream, crosses the placenta, and infects the calf. That's what we call vertical transmission. This is the type of infection that can result in a persistently infected animal. So, as Dr. Ridcap said, these persistently infected animals are little virus factories. They have a tremendous amount of virus being produced, and it's being shed every day of their life. And it's the primary tissues are, we have nasal secretions, eye secretions, to some extent feces, but not typically, but all of these secretions will contain the virus and then can pass from one animal to another. It's been found that only an hour's contact with a PI animal, persistently infected animal, can cause transmission to cattle in contact. So it's a relatively short period of time, relatively easy for the virus to move from a persistently infected animal to those animals that are in contact with it. Air transport is likely over short distances. And I want to point that out as both a positive and a negative. It doesn't seem to transport over great distances via air. I don't know exactly how many feet that is, but not great distances, but it will some distances. So that's both positive and negative. It's not truly an airborne pathogen that can travel great distances, but it will move a little distance anyway by air. Now, when we talk about persistently infected animals being able to infect their pen mates pretty quickly within 1 hour, transiently infected animals are not that efficient. They're going to need longer contact, more intimate contact to effectively get the virus moving around in the herd. Again, it can be done, but they're not as efficient transmitter of the virus as are persistently infected animals. So if we have look at some different scenarios, different ways, and begin be thinking about how this is going to cost me economically. If I have some suckling calves on the ground, and they were born healthy, they were not exposed in utero, they were not exposed during pregnancy, and then they are exposed to the virus. Maybe one of their little buddies out there with them is a persistently infected animal, so they're exposed to the virus. We do see immunosuppression, as Dr. Ridcap said, and it's not uncommon at all to have BVD as a component of scour outbreaks in suckling calves. Particularly, I suspect BVD as part of a scour outbreak when everything else seems to be fine. The sanitation is good. The dispersion, the calves are out on a wide pasture. They're not supposed to be having scours, and then they do. I oftentimes start looking for BVD because it may be involved in those kinds of situations. Respiratory disease, both in suckling calves, but also we start talking about this when we are purchasing soccer cattle, feedlot cattle. Because of the immunosuppression effects of BVD, it sets those cattle up for other pathogens to come in and cause problems. So the potential costs to a cow calf producer looking at his suckling calf losses are increasing cases of these other diseases, not defined exactly as BVD, but because of the immunosuppression we see them. So we talk about scours, pneumonia, pink eye. basically any suckling calf disease problem you can. We have at least some anecdotal reports that BDD can be involved. We have increased treatment costs dealing with these problems. Now, and I'm going to get into a lot more about how do we nail down how much a disease costs, which is an interesting exercise and a difficult exercise. But there's great variation. A group of suckling kids that are exposed to virus in one herd may have a different economic cost than in another herd. And a lot of that difference may be due to the BDD virulence. Some of these viruses are more virulent than others, causing a greater degree of immunosuppression. So that's going to cause some of the differences in cost that we may see from one farm to another. But the other is the susceptibility of the calf. And a lot of that has to do with the husbandry that those calves are being exposed to. So all of those will add to the variation we see in the cost of BDD problems in suckling kids. Now if we look at cows, what's going to be the cost of BDD infection in my adult cows? Well, if those cows are open, they're not pregnant at the time, we do see reduced fertility if those cows are susceptible to BDD and the virus gets a good foothold, starts replicating in the cow, we will see some ovarian effects. Now this may be no noticeable effect, particularly if the cows are fairly well protected. They have good immunity against this virus. The negative effects on them reproductively may be pretty mild, may be totally unnoticeable. We can also run into situations where when we're tracking the number of cows that get pregnant per day or per week, that it's lagging behind. They're not all open, but they're not getting pregnant as fast as what we'd really like. And that often results in kind of a strung out calving compared to the management that we've imposed. This group of cows was pretty tightly calving previous years, and nutrition was good, bull power was good, and yet for some reason we ended up with calving being distributed over a larger, longer period of time. And again, our overall pregnancy percentage may be okay, but it's spread over a longer period of time. Now, if this BDD is in pregnant cows, we worry about fetal infection, and if with any trimester, basically you can get a fetal death and damage there, and those cows are open at preg check. If we look at kind of backing up in time, if we look at the third trimester, a lot of those cattle, if they're the first time they're exposed to the virus in the third trimester, a lot of those calves will survive. They may be normal, or as Dr. Rizpath indicated, they may have some increased health problems, but they're born looking clinically normal and are not considered, not visibly a huge problem. Second trimester, the fetus may survive and may appear normal. This is when we can get a persistently infected calf born if the cow is exposed during this period of time. And also we see the birth defects, some of the birth defects we see with BDD. And in the first trimester, we may see embryo or fetal death, so that we don't necessarily see the abortion, but the early embryo may be resorbed and that cow may end up open, or if she gets rebred later in the breeding season as part of the strung out breeding or calving season. And also late in the first trimester we see PI calf being born. And in a certain number of cases, particularly if that cow has a good immune response to BDD, she's exposed to the virus, she may clear it, not cross placenta, not infect the calf. So all of those are potential outcome of affecting BDD virus infecting the pregnant cow. So when we look at cows, we talk about the cost to my suckling calf of BDD entering the herd. What is the cost to the cow herd side of the equation if BDD enters the herd? We may have reduced number of cows pregnant. We may see increased abortions and stillborns. That's as bad as being open. And again, the variation we see will be due to the virus itself, virulence differences in the virus, as well as the susceptibility of the cows. Either through natural exposure or vaccine exposure, there is some protection to BDD, ranging from pretty darn good to somewhat less. And again, that range in protection may have a lot to do with what Dr. Rizpath was saying, the genetic diversity of this virus. If the cow herd was naturally exposed to a similar virus in the past and then is exposed again, we think that protection is pretty darn good. If it's enough genetically different, that protection may be much less. So natural exposure appears to give pretty good protection in a lot of cases, but it's not 100%, particularly if the genetic diversity of the exposure is pretty wide. And then another big difference in the cost, and again, I'm looking at how much this disease is costing my cow herd, is what was the stage of gestation when the virus came into the herd? If it was early in gestation and the herd was pretty susceptible, I'm going to have pretty severe economic losses. If it was later enough in gestation, my economic losses may be much less. Same amount of exposure, same virus, same virulence of virus, so the stage when that occurs can also affect how much economic loss I'm going to have. Whittam did a survey a few years ago that was working at trying to find out how many PI grads are out there. And they used survey data from a lot of different states utilizing practicing veterinarians from around the country. And they found a fairly good number of herds that they were able to isolate PI calves out of these cattle herds. Because they found herds from a diverse part of the country, diverse parts of the country, from a fairly large number, I'm going to assume that they got a pretty good cross-section of what BDD can do in herds. Okay? Some of these herds, that PI, the virus was introduced fairly late, and the herd was fairly immune. Other herds may be the worst situation. It was the virus was introduced early in gestation, and the herd was very exposed. So there's going to be some variation. So I'm going to assume that they had a good cross-section. So we used the model. We used that data, and I worked with some ag economists at the University of Missouri, to work up a model to try to begin to get a handle on how much is this disease costing. So we used the Whittam data to start looking at that. We came up with $20 per cow. I almost hate to put that in print because it starts to look like a real number. and it's not. It's based on some data we had from this trial and using real cattle prices and real feed prices, what are some beginning estimates of how much this disease costs. And also when I throw out that $20 per cow number, and again, I'm saying it's a fuzzy number, and I'm the one that wrote it. So, when you start throwing out that, everybody in the audience, veterinarians, producers, say, well, it's way worse than that, or it's not that bad. That's exactly right. I expect this kind of distribution. Half the time it's going to be worse than that, half the time it's going to be better than that. And so when we talk about the cost of disease, our estimate is the average is somewhere around $20, and this is up to weaning. This is for a cow-calf herd, the economic cost thing. And again, the variation, this spread here, differences in virulence from one outbreak to another, the susceptibility of the herd. Had they had previous natural exposure, had they been well vaccinated, all of those things are going to greatly affect how much economic cost there is to exposing that herd to the virus. The stage of the pregnancy, we've discussed that. And animal husbandry, other diseases that are present on the herd. What's sanitation like? What's nutrition? All of those things are going to impact the cost then of having BDD in the herd. So again, now not only does a herd have we estimate around $20 cost, is it worth going after? And in a little bit I'm going to talk about some control programs. At $20 a head, is it worth going after this disease in a cow-calf herd? Well, the answer is if I know it's in there, because I took this out over a 10-year period, and we're looking at continued losses over a number of years. And if I institute a screening program, get in and find the PI animal, get rid of them, get rid of that big source of virus, and get that out of there, I have economic benefit for more than that year. Okay? So because I have economic benefit for more than that year, the value of me finding that is more than $20 a head. Because that $20 was 1 year's loss. So using that in mind, and a protocol where we screen the entire herd for 1 year and then all replacements after that, we figure that if there are PI animals in there, the average is going to give us about a $60 to $80 return for doing that. Now, the problem is, so basically the answer is, if you're pretty darn sure there's PIs in there, I'm pretty darn sure they'll economically reward you to go get them over the next few years. I can say that with pretty good confidence. Now, the question is, though, what if I don't know if there's PI animals in that herd? And when I was in practice, that would be most of my clients. I don't know if there's PI animals in that herd or not. So is it worth going in and doing an aggressive whole herd screening? The answer to that is probably not, or somewhere between maybe and probably not. Okay. So if we are able to categorize herds by risk category, either into high risk or low risk, then we can start making some of these decisions on what kind of that control program should I put in place. If it's a high risk, I'll probably do some screening. If it's a low risk, I probably won't. So the high risk herds, in my opinion, benefit from whole herd screening. They benefit from a pretty aggressive control program. Low risk herds probably do not. So I want to make that call on a herd by herd basis if I was your practicing veterinarian. So the potential cost, and I've got about 2 minutes, right? Okay. Let's talk about potential cost post-weaning. Because that $20 figure that I came up with was for the cow-calf guy selling at weaning. There's additional cost, of course, to the industry. And we look at some post-weaning costs. Again, similar to pre-weaning, we have the other diseases. Because of the immune suppression effects of this virus, we expect to see some other diseases causing increased costs. We have the treatment costs for those. We also have reduced performance that we see in post-weaning calves. So in feedlot operations, a couple of things. If you are a stocker operator, feedlot operator, rather than a cow-calf person, so how much is DVD costing me? It's a very good question. Because PI cattle tend to die, the older they are, the less likely there are to be PI cattle in the group. Okay? So I expect higher percentage of PI cattle in my stocker operations with calf beds than I would feedlots that buy primarily yearly. So the cost to that operation is going to go down the older the cattle is that you deal with. There have been a couple of reports showing that BDD virus is associated with respiratory disease outbreaks in feedlots. And again, I'm going to focus on these PI cattle because I'm going to talk about some control programs later, and they are the typhoid mary of BDD. They are the primary reservoir, and if we can get rid of them, we get rid of a huge percentage of the circulating virus. So if we look at a recently published trial showed that about 2-3% of the cattle in a chronic can at one feedlot were PIs, and 3-4% of the beds. That may seem like a high number or a low number to you. You may have wished that was a higher number. But heck, if we got rid of the PIs, we'd get rid of half our beds. And I can't give you that one. It's not that bad as far as just your beds. Now, it still has a tremendous cost because of what it's doing to the rest of the cattle in the pens. So we see few, if any, of the PI cattle actually survive to be slaughtered with their pen mates. They either die or are realized prior to that time. Treatment of those cattle is futile because they're going to die probably, but you end up putting a lot of money into them. The interesting thing is the presence of a PI animal can increase the pull rate in that pen. So my medicine costs, my performance costs go up for the in-contact animals, not only, of course, that PI animal. And that's where the real cost is. Much bigger cost than the cost, the loss of that PI animal. It's what he's doing to his pen mates. The frustrating thing is, well, maybe I'll just start doing a screening at arrival, at a stocker operation. And that probably has some value, but from an economic standpoint, the problem is a lot of times if I find one there and he came in on a potload, you know, I've already got the virus going. I may save me some problems, but I've already caused an economic loss. So my economic reward for screening at that time is less than if I had done it a day earlier. Significantly less, I think. The economic costs we have are the treatment costs, the death of the PI animals, reduced gain in the in-contact pen mates, and increased death from chronic. Now, I gave you my estimate of around $20 for a year in to year out cost of a BDD PI animal in cow-calf herds. What is it in feedlot operations? That I don't feel like I've got a very good answer for. A couple of papers have been published, a couple of papers have not been published that are kind of getting out there. And the cost I have seen have run from zero to about $2,000. Now you said $2,000, where does that come from? Again, that's contact with, you know, 200 calves in his own pen plus the pens on each side, reduced gain, reduced carcass value, those kind of things. And zero, where does that come from? Well, that's a bell-shaped curve. There was at least one trial where they really couldn't find much of an economic cost. So somewhere, maybe in there, And hopefully we will be learning that in the next couple of years. What is this costing us at the stock or in the feeder level? I don't have as good a feel for that. But it's a fairly good, it's an additional number to that $20. That's it? That's my two-year-old daughter. And we're going to have time for questions later, right, honey?
Yes. We work on that, Dr. Larson. Thank you very much for trying to put economics to that. Well, this is Fast Pace. We've got one more session coming, and then we'll have a break. But Dr. Woodpath is going to come back and talk about surveillance. You know, how do we test and look for it? We're going to break and then come back. And just to remind you, Dr. Greens will be coming on to talk about vaccination. And then after that, Dr. Larson is going to hit the home run and try to figure out how do you implement it on your farm with this. Anyway, I apologize that we had a really good attendance for this session, and so we did not have enough handouts. So Renee Lloyd is making handouts for this, but unfortunately they won't be available till tomorrow morning. So our MCBA apologizes for those of you who did not get any handouts. But if you go to the business the headquarters office tomorrow morning, there will be extra copies available. And once again, you know, take-home information is very important on there. Okay. Thank you, Dr. Burns. Is there someone who needs one? Oh, Dr. Spire, AABP president. There we go. All right, Dr. Woodcock. Thank you very much.
So now perhaps gotten worried about what BVD might be doing to you, now you'd like to know how you find it. And so we're going to talk about surveillance systems here, when and how to look for BVD infections. Surveillance, you can look for symptoms and lesions, but as we've been saying through the past two talks, it may look like just about anything out there. You're going to look for patterns, particularly with in reproductive outbreaks where you have delayed breedings. You may not be looking for an outright clinical disease, but patterns where you're experiencing loss where loss shouldn't be. Pay special attention to your vulnerable populations. Talk a little bit more about that later. And then you have to pick a laboratory test that works with your management system. You have to figure out what you want to know and who do you want to test. So looking for symptoms and lesions, this is probably the most ineffective way to survey for BVD. The classic signs just aren't reliable. And you're not just talking about PI animal. If you kind of get into that boat, well, if I get rid of all my PIs, I won't have a BVD problem anymore. Lots of times when guys have PI animals, they get rid of them, they still haven't experienced the problem. In subsequent breeding seasons, it's because there's an acute infection running through there. So realize that acute disease is a big part of the picture. Whereas the PI animals keep everything in play, they are not the only thing that's going on. And realize that fetal infections, it may not be evident in the pregnant mother, may result in the death of the fetus, giving you a difference in the pattern of reproduction that might clue you on to something that's going on. Looking for these congenital defects in these poor doing animals. Now, the origin of BVD outbreaks, when you're going to be setting up a surveillance system, and I'm supposed to be talking about detection here, but you have to understand where BVD outbreaks come from so you know where to look. You may have direct contact with a PI animal. You may have a contact with an acutely infected bovine who might have been infected by a PI animal, but now it's progressing down as one infects the other. You can have contact with infected wildlife. There are persistently infected deer. There are persistently infected elk, and BVD can jump over your fence and share the salt block with the cattle during the winter or feed bumps. Indirect means you can have contaminated equipment, so you can carry it from pen to pen. If you save colostrum from year to year and you have an animal that was infected, there will be virus in the colostrum, and BVD does freeze well. That's why I preserve it in the laboratory. We can also have contaminated biologics. Embryo transplant is a big one because of the frequency of contamination of fetal calf serum that's used commercially to produce these embryos. We also haven't talked too much about this this morning, but semen can be infected with BVD. And so that can be another source of BVD to your herd. Contact with persistent infected animals versus other mechanisms. If you have a PI in the herd, actually the number of new outbreaks of BVD is greater than the number of PI animals we ever identified, which leads us to believe a lot of BVD out there is being caused by acute infection. But if you have a PI animal in the herd, the spread within the herd is generally pretty fast. And the secondary spread is as a result of this original PI being there. So if you're spreading it by other means, by mechanical means, by animals coming over by the fence, by sharing equipment with other operations, the initial phase may be a short duration with only a few animals infected, and then you get a slow, prolonged spread throughout your operation. So if you have a PI, you pretty much get everybody relatively fast exposed. If it's by some other means, and it's being spread just acutely or by mechanical means, that's going to be slower. And that's the one that drives you nuts. It's a little bit harder to figure out what's going on. Peak times of BVD infections. These are our vulnerable populations, and these are the populations we want to pay attention to, because this is where BVD is going to hit you. Fetal infections. Those fetuses are vulnerable. You want to worry about infection there. It's hard to survey, however, fetuses. We can do amniocentesis, but it's really hard to figure out how many infected fetuses you have on Earth. At 6 months, this is the end of passive immunity. Weaning's happening in here. Sometimes we're being moved to other herds and we're being mixing calves. That's the peak time where BVD's going to hit. Mixing at stockyards and sale barns, where you're getting exposed to new strains and new animals, that's another peak time. So this is where you're looking for BVD to hit. This is to remind me about the pregnant heifer. You know, a lot of fairy tales begin with once upon a time. A lot of the stories I hear about BVD begin with, and I brought some pregnant heifers. BVD frequently comes into a herd. As Dr. Larson told you, the dam will have antibodies against BVD. She doesn't necessarily have to be PI herself, because some of these animals are mixed in the early stages of pregnancy by cattle jockeys. They're a vulnerable population. They have a tendency to see more BVD, and they'll come in carrying this persistently infected fetus, and you have no way of knowing that fetus is infected. Detection. Surveillance based on epidemiology. We probably don't do really enough of that. Plotting where BVD is coming from, where it's been frequently, and maybe this is going to improve a little bit if we do go to a national identification system on cattle, so you can go back and see where that virus is coming from. Consider viral traffic signals. What do I mean by that? Consider changes that's happening to your herd. Because anytime you have a change, you have a greater tendency to bring BVD in. So if you're bringing in stalker animals from operations you haven't brought them in before, if you're combining herds, if you're expanding herds, these are all signals that you tend to have more viral infections in general. We're talking BVD in particular, but you're going to have more pathogens when you're doing things like this, when you're making changes. Observe those most vulnerable populations. The fetus, the weaned calf, the stalker calf, the feedlot animal. Those are where you're going to be having problems. And always consider pathogens as causes. I showed you those pictures of those calves before, those dumpy-looking calves. Don't always ascribe things to poor nutrition or stress or, you know, just bad genetics. A lot of these things are due to infectious diseases, and one of the infectious diseases out there that's causing a lot of problems is BVD because of those PI animals running around. So test. Everybody wants this bottom line. Which test I should use? Well, which test you use really depends on when you want to test. It depends on which animal you need to test, and from there you're going to decide which test to use. So you're going to have to decide, are you looking specifically for BVD? Do you think you have a BVD problem? Or are you trying to keep BVD out of your herd? Or you just want to do a surveillance to know what your health, your herd health is? So based on clinical signs, on acute infections, not very good. All the PI animals may not look like PI. So, and the pathology, once again, will depend on, as we keep hammering on you, on the age of the animal, the reproductive status, the immune status, and the presence of other pathogens. So detection based on clinical signs is very unreliable with these viruses. Detection in the laboratory. If you send them in, they can do three main categories. Virus isolation, and this is really the gold standard. It's also the most time-consuming and the most expensive, and you have to have a pretty good lab to be able to do it. Detection of antigen immunohistochemistry on ear notches is becoming very popular out there. It seems to do a really good job of picking up persistent infections that will not show you an acute infection. So you can have, just because you're not finding an ear notch positive animal in your herd does not mean you don't have BVD there. It just means you don't have persistently infected animal there. They're also doing ELISA out of ear notch samples, and that's also based on detection of antigen. They sometimes do ELISA on tissue sections that are coming into the lab, but I don't think anybody's really using that as surveillance. PCR. PCR can be done on pooled samples, unlike these other ones. So you can do it on pooled serum samples, pooled buffy coat samples. You can do it on pooled milk samples, colostrum samples. It really just gives you a positive or negative. It can just give you a positive or negative, but you can use it to give you a differential, tell you whether it's a type 1 or a type 2 out there, to tell you maybe, if you combine it with sequencing, to tell you whether it's a vaccine strain or a wild type strain. And so these may be answers you want. But the test depends on what you're looking for. If you're screening for what's coming into your herd and you just want to prevent BVD from coming in, this might be your best bet. It's relatively cheap, but it has to be done on an individual animal basis. If you're looking for screening of a herd, you just want to know if something maybe kind of suspect something's there, you can go to a pooled serum sample. This is going to be cheaper. Eventually, you're going to have to go down to individual samples, but you can start there. And you have to work this out with the veterinarian. Okay, but if you really want to know what's going on, you might have to go back to the virus isolation. This may tell you, is it the same virus I got out last year? Is it a vaccine strain? Am I having new strains walking in, or am I having the same problem year to year? And serology may reveal a smoking gun. Sometimes you say, well, if you've been vaccinating, I don't know if the serology results are going to do any good. When I talk about serology, I'm talking about the antibody titer that the whole herd is carrying. You will have, vaccination does give rise to antibody titers, but those titers tend to be a lot higher when BVD is present. So if you're seeing titers of above 1 to 1,000, more than likely, those may not be vaccination, all related to vaccination. So serology may give you a smoking gun. And also, if you go to the laboratory, make sure they're doing the tests against both the type 1 and the type 2. Because I showed you in the first talk, the serology can have quite a bit of difference. So you may only have a 1 to 10 titer against the type 1, and it may be a 1 to 1,000 against the type 2. And that will indicate to you that it's the type 2 popping through. So a differential serology can give you some information. Choosing a diagnostic test, as I say, depends on what you want to know, what type of sampling you want to do, and if you suspect BVD is already in your herd or not. And Dr. Larson did a good job of estimating some of those costs for you. Now, we have to talk a little bit of acute versus PI, because most of those tests I just talked about, the ones that are in use in the field, are set up to detect persistent infections. And occasionally, we are really worried about acute infections, not persistent infections, particularly in respiratory disease and feedlot animals. Even though a PI animal might have picked it off, the damage that is happening is due to acute infections. So you're going to have to trace that back. And these losses of severe acute can approach 50% in some herds. And we have to realize, even if the PI animal is the original source, that they've already set off an acute outbreak, even getting rid of them is not getting rid of the problem because the virus is already present. So as we talk about testing for BVD, if we're just testing for PIs, we're really just looking at the tip of the iceberg. If we're just looking for classical symptoms, we're really looking at just the tip of the iceberg. There's a lot of BVD out there. There's a lot more acute cases of BVD out there than there are persistently infected cases. So occasionally I'll get somebody in and say, well, I just found one PI. It can't be that much of a problem. As we talked before, if you have even one PI, it represents a whole mountain of other stuff going on. I also have guys say, well, we didn't find any PI. We just found some acutely affected animals, and that's kind of disappointed in that. Acute infection is significant. Acute infection is where the rubber meets the road, and that's where you're getting your problem. The PI keeps it in play, but any finding of BVD in a herd is significant. Testing the test. Right now, to charge for doing BVD tests, all you have to do is have the courage to hang out your shingle and say, we do BVD tests. There's no proficiency testing for the United States. So we have no way of being able to tell you how good a laboratory is. So, and sometimes laboratories don't agree with each other. There was a push on FRISS to adopt standard operating procedures, saying this is the only way you could do a certain test. It's really not practical. So what we're looking at now is proficiency testing. And we hope to get that up this spring. And the reason I'm bringing it up to you, if you do have a persistently infected animal, I would like to hear from you. Because I'm collecting samples from proficiently persistently infected animals to go into this proficiency exam because we need samples. And we do pay for those, but if anybody comes across them, I would really like the samples. And then how often to test. If you have BVD there, this is something you want to work out with your veterinarian again. If you suspect BVD, you may be wanting to test every calf in the crop. If you just survey, you may be just picking out samples from your operation. But you have to work that out with your veterinarian to determine how often you're going to be testing. And you certainly want to look at testing things that you are bringing in. And this is just a little morality tale for BVD, because, you know, why would I ever want to know what, you know, go to all the work of sequencing and figuring out what the genotype is of that virus? And how far back do I test this? Once again, this is, instead of my once upon a time, this one starts with my brother and I decided to combine herds. This is a milking operation. And they were originally using a vaccine protocol, 2 doses of killed vaccine, type 1 and type 2 at dry off, and 2 to 3 weeks postpartum. Didn't really experience any problems. I had a field rep talk to them and convinced them to go to a different vaccination protocol of 1 dose killed at dry off and 1 dose modified live of just a type 1A vaccine 3 to 4 weeks postpartum. And this is where they changed vaccination protocols and had an abortion storm where they lost 48 animals at the end of 2000. And so immediately they went in and said, well, this vaccination program doesn't work. And we talked to them, and so we tested all these animals and we characterized the virus that we got out. And then we said, well, you know, maybe you want to go back and go do just a little bit more testing, just to see if it was here more than 1 year. Well, when they did go back and test, they found that they had an animal here that had the same virus that they had here. So the virus had been there for more than a year. And while they were wanting to say that this vaccination protocol wasn't working for them, this animal had been infected during the old vaccination protocol. And we suspect this virus had been kind of bubbling around the background. This vaccination protocol didn't allow it to break out and cause it some real disease problems as far as reproductive disease. Sort of kind of kept it under control, but didn't eliminate it, and certainly didn't get rid of the PI animal. Switching to this vaccination protocol allowed it to take off in the herd. So when the producer then asked me who the son of a bitch was, the guy who sold him this, or the guy who sold him this, there were probably 2 of them. So this is just, you know, you have to be Columbo to figure out what's happening out with these outbreaks. And it can't be just test this calf crop, or just a one-time. BVD control is going to be a program. It's not going to be a one-shot deal.
As you can tell, Dr. Woodpack is a gem, and we're very lucky to have her with USDA and MADC and AIDS Iowa.